Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
An Erio's original.
Looking back at it 40 years ago and what we looked like and how we dressed and the makeup and everything, it was amazing.
So amazing and so feminist and so rock and roll.
The fact that I came out at 14 years old, I had a personal stake in trying to make a difference and move things, you know, in a better direction.
Hi, this is Margaret Cho. You're listening to The Margaret Cho. Today, we have a very special guest. We have Belinda Carlisle. I am a huge fan, of course, from the legendary band The Go-Go's, a solo artist. She's an animal activist, an amazing singer, and yeah, she's joining me from all the way in Bangkok, Thailand, and I'm so excited to have her with me today. You look great.
I do.
You look so beautiful. How are you so young, literally Belinda Buttons?
Well, you know, I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't do drugs anymore. I have a daily pranayama and yoga practice. I think that's a lot of it, oxygenating the skin. Mm. And I don't eat meat. I think mm-hmm. I said that. But yeah, I mean, you know, just healthy living, everything in moderation.
It's great. Yeah. It's great. I mean, I think that it's really inspiring. But I mean, you always look great. All throughout all of the different times I've seen you, and I've been a fan. The first time I saw you was the vacation tour. That was the first time I saw you live, the vacation tour, which I guess would be 1984? Is that 80?
I think 82 or 83.
It must have been actually 82. It was the Greek Theater in Berkeley. It was the Blasters.
I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that. Yeah.
That
yeah.
was such a huge thing. And that show was like such a crazy, amazing experience. I mean, that whole tour was it was the wildest. I mean, did you guys know what huge stars you were?
Well, I think, you know, at the time, you know, from the making of that album to, you know, through 1984, it was a whirlwind. So we knew, we had an idea that, you know, we were a very popular band, and just by the venues and that we would play, we know we had a huge audience. We knew that, but I don't think as far as like enjoying it at the time, I mean, we enjoyed it, but it was just, we were running ragged. You know, we were just, mm-hmm. we were on the road constantly, and, you know, we loved it. And we knew we had something. About that time, it started becoming a business, which was a little bit different from the beginning. It was 99.9% of those memories are great.
Yes. And I really enjoyed the documentary because it really took me back to a great time, which a lot of that footage I had never seen. And, did it also bring it back for you too?
Oh my God. Well, first of all, the fact that they were able to get that archival footage is really pretty amazing because that's, you know, before the time of mobile phones, you know, filming. Right. And it was just, it was amazing that somebody actually I don't know who, what, or where it came from, but somebody documented a little bit of that whole time. And it was such an incredible time. Just energetically. And I mean, looking at that footage, I thought, God, we were really cool.
Really at the time cool.
You don't feel like you're that cool, of course, because you're kids and whatever. I mean, looking back at it, you know, 40 years ago, and what we looked like and how we dressed and the makeup and everything, it was amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. So amazing and so feminist and so rock and roll and really fun. And actually, the look holds up. Like, it looks great. Like, if you went out in those outfits today, it would look amazing.
Exactly. And they would probably cost, you know, at least a few hundred dollars.
But back
then, you know, we had no money. So everything that we bought was like 75 cents, mm-hmm. you know, $2, because we had no money. But we were so well put together. And you're right. It still holds up to this day. It would, you know, it would cost a fortune to dress like that now. But we did it on nothing. I mean, if there was an article of clothing that I was like lusting over, because I was always really into fashion, I worked as a secretary in the very beginning, you know, in the early days. So I would just eat oatmeal for a few weeks and just save my money for like a pair of Maud Frazone shoes or Emmanuel Kahn sunglasses. So I was always really into fashion, but most of what I wore was, you know, less than $5 for sure.
It's so fabulous. And I mean, no matter what, everything you were wearing still, even if it was like a garbage bag, it still looked so chic. I mean, I think I actually did see you wear something like a garbage bag. Like at one point, something was like a plastic bag, but it was so chic, like with belts and heels.
Yeah, with belted, you know, I take a big hefty bag, cut the bottom, put my neck through, you know, holes for my arms, belt it with, you know, it was a red belt usually, and fishnets and a little beret, and I was ready to go.
Was that in an UGA music war or something? I think it
was UGA music war. Well, that dress was like one of those red sort of silk Chinese dresses.
Oh,
that
yes.
you used to get stores.
Right.
And, you know, it was probably maybe $3 tops because that's all I could afford. But yeah, I mean, I look back at that now. And at the time I felt, of course, self-conscious because being a young girl, whatever. And I look at it now going, oh my God, I was so cute.
So beautiful. such a beauty. And it was so fun though, because I feel like you gave the school beauty permission to be punk rock. You know,
I mean, in those early days, I was really a big fan of the whole rockabilly movement that was going on at the time, too. And that was really super feminine. And so I kind of drew from that sometimes with what I was wearing. A lot of times I would wear sort of a rockabilly prom dress, of course, torn stockings and little stilettos and had the short punk hair. But yeah, I mean, it was okay to look feminine. And, you know, a lot of it was, a lot of looks back then that the women were wearing, you know, was had more of a harder edge. But I always, you know, liked looking feminine. So I just brought that little twist to what I, you know, wore and the way I looked.
Yeah, I love that. I think that you brought a lot of that sort of flirtatious, coy, girlish quality to punk rock, which I think is really a fun thing, which we didn't really have. You could have the very kind of hard mohawk thing, they had this thing, you know, if you were punk, you had to be boyish. And you were coming out saying, well, no, you can still be a girl and you can still love punk rock. And I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we were all pretty much, I mean, we were all feminine actually at the same time as being feminists but feminists and only as we did what we wanted to do and didn't really think about a gender, you know, mm-hmm. it was like anything, you know, anything went, we could do what we wanted. Of course, the industry was run by men, but so what, you know, we were going to succeed anyway. We never let that get in our way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. It's great. I really enjoyed all of your style evolutions all the way through, whether it was a concho belt, Western shirt thing, and then going into talk show. Well, the talk show with the talk show was sort of kind of the sweatshirt with the like neckband cutout era.
Flash dance before flash dance.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the first time I'd seen that. That's amazing.
That was definitely a look. You know, I had lots of great looks, but I had lots of really scary looks too. And some of that in there with the hair, actually the torn sweatshirt thing wasn't so bad, but I look at some of my outfits go, oh my God, what was I thinking? You know, there's a few stinkers in there.
I don't think so. I think they were all great. I mean, I really love the talk show era. I also loved the I get weak era. I like the sort of the French, the chanson era too, with the cat eye eyeliner. And I mean, it was a very chanson kind of period, which I think is also a great style moment for you too.
Right. Well, I mean, as I, you know, after leaving the Go-Go's, and I never really thought so much about my image or whatever. I sort of winged it as I went along, but I always had a real sort of love for those glamour pusses of, like, mm-hmm. you know, the 40s and 50s. And that was kind of thrown in a lot of the Heaven album. I mean, yeah, from the Heaven album, Runaway Horses. And then, of course, you say chanson, which I always fancied myself a little bit of a chanteuse.
Yes, yes.
And that was what I did a French album called Voila, because I lived in France for about 25 years. And so I always thought that had a little bit of, I had a little bit of the chanteuse in me. And then, of course, with the album Voila, I sort of looked at Piaf and a lot of those French chanteuses of the time. But I always loved that glamorous makeup. Paul Starr did a lot of my makeup back then, and he was a genius. And Peter Savick did a lot of my hair back then. And they got what I was going for. But like I always said, I winged it as I went along. And I was really lucky in that way, where I was always allowed 100% artistic freedom with as far as, well, most of the time with music, but as far as the image that I wanted to portray. So, yeah. And a lot, that doesn't happen a lot these days.
Yeah, but it was a good time, I think, for you coming out. I mean, it was a really perfect time to come out of the band and then go into solo recording career and then have this great success as a singer and a very strong image to go along with it. And then it was good to, like, I mean, I think it was a great way to kind of mature into this, like, rock star and yet have, you know, like, this very mature image to go along with it, which I think was really elegant.
Right. Well, you know, when I left the band, I had, you know, I stopped drinking. I, you know, had this, and most of it was transitioning from a teenager, really. I looked like a teenager when I was in the Go-Go's, to all of a sudden transitioning into a young woman. So that right there, I think, was shocking for a lot of people, because there was such a visible difference. But it really, I mean, I was 26, 27 years old at the time. So I was a young woman, and I started looking like a young woman. And that was, that first album cover was sort of modeled on an old Anne Margaret photograph. I forgot what it was from, where she was all in black and sitting on a chair. So, and chairs, I like to sit down during photo sessions anyways. I never like to stand up. So that kind of worked for me. And that was like a really, at the time, that was such a strong image. And still to this day, the hot pink background with all in black, sort of very styled and shot by Matthew Ralston. But yeah, I mean, with the help of a team of photographers and you know, the artists and stylists, that it really projected a pretty glamorous image.
Yeah. And it's just, it's wonderful. It's like, it's a lot. I mean, it's a lot of changes that you've gone through. And I read your book, and it was so amazing too. Like, I was, just so incredibly shocked and moved at the depth that you went into, like, all of the stuff in the hotel in London and everything. I mean, it was just really deep and dark, and because I'm Sobes also, so it was like a very intense journey. And I mean, it's an amazing book, and I really think what a rock memoir, but also what an intense experience to go through. What did you feel like when you were doing, did you want to just like get it all out there? And
well, I always thought that I had a book in me because mm-hmm. I've had this extraordinary life, but I always felt that it had to have some sort of, angle on it. And, I needed a little bit of time. Well, going back to when I was, dropped by my record company at 40, I mean, I'd always been defined by what I did. And now I never really dug deep. So digging deep, and that actually from the age 40 to present has been the most interesting time of my life. So about 3 years into my sobriety, I thought that I was ready and I could write a book that was not just a memoir and a little bit of dirty laundry, of course, because people like that, a little bit of titillation. Mm-hmm. The theme being, in a nutshell, that you can teach an old dog new tricks. Mm-hmm. And I had been, you know, an addict since I was age 17, really, mm-hmm. Until 47 when I got sober. I'm 62 now. I had dabbled with sobriety, like I said, when I left the band, but I didn't do the work. And it was my idea of sobriety, which was, I can't do coke, but I can take pills and smoke pot and drink white wine. And that was my version. And of course, it's a slippery slope, as you know, it's a slippery slope. So when I had a 3-day, 4-day bender in London at the very, after 30 years of drinking and using, pretty much, you know, with the exception of when I wasn't pregnant, I hit a spiritual bottom. So when I was writing the book, I wanted to, tell my story, but also tell the story of fighting demons, my personal demons, and being able to win that battle, which I struggled with for 30 years. So it was a really, really hard process. I've been through therapy and I've been through the 12-step program. And, you know, personal inventory and all that stuff is really, really hard work. I always said it was like, you know, putting cement in your boots and wading through quicksand in the fog. That's what it's like for me, trying to dig it up.
Yeah,
trying to, like, excavate it. All the feelings. And writing that book, a lot of realizations came up that that didn't come up in therapy and didn't come up when I was doing personal inventory in my 12-step program. So it was a really hardcore process for me and a really emotional thing, a process. And I don't think I'll ever do it again.
Well, I think it was so deep. I mean, it was a deep journey. And also from as a fan to never have known, because you would never assume, because your life looks so perfect from the outside. Right. Nobody would ever have known. You know?
No, I mean, I did a pretty good job of hiding things
until
the end, when it was just obvious that there was a gigantic problem. But a lot of my life has been about, you know, hiding and secrets and it's a horrible, horrible way to live. And I did a lot of my life in that sort of vortex of secrets and lies and stuff. Yeah, it was an intense project, an intense process. But I think that, you know, the feedback that I've gotten from that book through the years, you know, they use it sometimes in rehabs.
Yeah, they should.
As like a, is like an inspirational story of like, yeah, you know, you might be 47 years old, but you can still turn it around. And
absolutely.
And I did. Yeah. And I did. And yeah. it was, I think, you know, everybody says, was it really hard for you? And no, it wasn't actually. I think once I decided I can't do this anymore, that was it. You know, I made as I was in my last binge, I was, you know, chopping out lines, sitting in by myself for 3 days in a hotel room, by the way. And then, you know, I had an auditory hallucination that said, okay, you're going to die. And I said, okay, I'll stop, I promise, but just let me finish what I have. Mm-hmm. And then I'll do it. And actually, after that, that was it. And I think for me, the most difficult part was getting used to living in serenity and having, mm-hmm. and because I was not only addicted to alcohol and had a, you know, mostly cocaine, but I also was addicted to drama. And that was the hardest part for me, is learning to live and enjoy a life of serenity, you know, and no drama.
Yeah.
And I prefer it that way.
Yeah. I know peace is something that it's different. I mean, it's definitely something that I have to learn how to be comfortable with. Peace is certainly something new for me too.
Oh, I used to sit in meetings and go, serenity, it's boring. I mean, you know, it's, I don't, you know, I don't know if I want serenity. I like it when it's all stirred up and there's chaos around me, but they would just say, you know, just, you'll get used to it. And actually I did it. It took a couple of years to get used to it. And I wouldn't have it any other way now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I used to say I can't imagine a day without a drug or without a drink. And now I can't imagine a day with one. So it's just, you know, as you know, it's like, it's a process. And in the beginning, the early days of sobriety for me were just different. It wasn't hard staying away from it, from, you know, my drugs and drink of choice, but it was just learning to do things. And I'll never forget, about 3 years into my sobriety, I was the last one to leave a party at like 2:30 in the morning, and I was sober, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. You know, I never thought I could do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's really amazing to find the innocence of just people and conversation and music and movies and food and just these like really basic pleasures that I always thought that I needed to be high for or something.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. It's, and to be present, you know, it's funny because when I first got sober and I had always gone on stage after a couple of drinks, you know, cause when I really think about what I do for a living, it's kind of, I used to be a ham, but I'm not so much of a ham anymore. But if I really think about what I do, I would like get freaked out. Like I'm actually, you know, in front of people doing something and all the eyes are on me. Mm-hmm. So when I first got sober, I thought, how am I can't go on stage without a drink. I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to go on stage without a drink or something. And I thought it was going to be really difficult, but actually I think it's a lot easier now because it's always about connecting to something bigger than yourself. I don't know if you feel the same way.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's way easier. I mean, it's way easier to perform. I mean, it's just also physically easier to tour. It's physically easier to do all of the things because it's rigorous to actually like travel and tour. I mean, obviously not right now because of COVID and everything, but usually when you're a touring artist, it's strenuous. So
yes, it is.
It's actually physically very hard, but just as a performer, it's really important to be present to connect to an audience. And, you know, it's hard to do that when you're altered.
Absolutely. And I always thought that I was, you know, great and sort of like, oh, Lucy, you know, loosey goosey. And then, but I would look back and I'm like horrified, you know, and I would go on stage completely smashed and, you know, think I'm funny and crack jokes. And I think it's kind of funny and kind of funny, but not really. And now it's like, you know, it's an energy exchange with the audience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with that buffer of like being loaded, it's like removed, and it's like you can connect more, and it's so much more enjoyable and so much more comfortable.
Yes, you're so right. I mean, I get really invested in the myth of artists that I like Serge Gainsbourg, or, you know, somebody who's like in a couple of cognac bottles in already, and they're like super or wasted, or like Edith Piaf is a good example of that, you know, just super like already in too deep, you know, or Janis Joplin, all the people that I really like love to get wasted before. And I think, you know, it's just that I idolize the myth of people like that. But
it's romantic.
You know, yeah, it's romantic.
There's a romance to this sort of elegantly wasted, you know, mm-hmm. artist. You know, mm-hmm. And it is cool. I mean, I just actually on Instagram, I just put up a picture of Serge Gainsbourg yesterday because I just think, you know, and I still think he's the coolest. But
yeah
there's the tortured artist thing, which I never considered myself to be, but I certainly appreciated it in others. And I always thought that was the coolest. You know, Keith Richards, who's like the ultimate, is like king of that.
Yeah. But yeah. Serge would have been so great what if he had gotten sober and lived? You know, what if he had gotten to live? That would have been so great. You know?
Yeah. You know, I remember that last, I met him actually.
In
San Remo Music Festival. I didn't really appreciate him at the time. I just thought he was like a dirty old man. But you know, he was working with Vanessa Paradis at the time. And I was like, we have to get her away from that dirty old man. But then doing research and living in France and like, oh my God, what was I thinking? He's like, you know, not always politically correct, but that's what's so great.
Yeah.
You know, and I just like love his interviews, and I don't know. I'm a huge fan of his, but yeah, I mean, I always loved that there's a romance in that kind of character.
Yeah, there is. And I mean, it is like, there is a potential. I think what I love is that also that there's an unrealized potential there too. Yeah. And, you know, maybe that's what I also love. Like, and you know, it's kind of like they took their talent for granted a little bit, you know, that's like they had so much talent that they could waste it all just by being fucked up.
I know. Well, he died fairly young, so he could have given us more. Absolutely. I love his later stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, artists still around like that have that thing, you know, and without naming names, that I just really respond to because they're kind of a mess.
Yeah.
And you can see that. It's like, oh my God, but their art and they're real and their authenticity. It's like, you know, it's just amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like that mystery, but it's like, I can't do it. And I'm 51, and so it's like, and I don't have a lot of chances to do it, and I've already spent all mine. It's like all of my lives are gone. I have this little dog to take care of. Do you have an animal? You have an animal foundation in Kolkata.
Yes, I do. Yeah, I always wanted to have a donkey sanctuary, and I've always been an animal rights advocate for like 30 years, and PETA and whatever. So some really good friends of mine from Seattle founded the first animal hospital animal sanctuary in India. And I went to go visit them because I have been to India numerous times. And this is what I want to do one day. This is exactly what I want to do. So I have some friends who work for NGOs in Calcutta, and they come for long weekends to Bangkok because I live in Bangkok. And one of them, Paul, said, I really want to do an animal hospital. And I thought, oh my God, I want to do that too. So we didn't really know what we were going to do, but there's such a big need for services in that area in Bengal. Mm-hmm. So we formed Animal People Alliance in 2014. Basically, we do on-site treatment. There's lots of animals that live on the street. We had a shelter for a while, but it worked better. We could get more done by going to the animal itself without stressing someone, a dog or a cat that's used to living on the street, because they like it. They sound like they're homeless. They love it. So, you know, we go around the city, Bahala region of Calcutta, and we've treated over like 17,000 animals since 2014.
Oh, wow.
And we just expanded to Chiang Rai, Thailand, and we have a shelter up there. And up there, we do more of adoption and education. So it's like my little baby. And,
yeah.
And so I don't have any dogs or cats with me here, but I have plenty up north.
Aww.
I have like 40 of them.
That's so incredible.
I know. It's amazing. And it's kind of found its feet. We're really well known in Calcutta, and I go whenever I can, because it's only a 2-hour flight for me. So I'm kind of back and forth, and the team are amazing. And it's actually kind of twofold, because what we do is we hire people who are at, vulnerable people like trafficked. We have a few women who have been trafficked. We train them to be dog handlers and paravets, or people who are at risk of falling below the line of poverty.
Yeah.
So it's like a twofold, creating employment for people. And in Thailand, we work mostly with stateless people, and stateless people have a problem doing anything in life because they have no papers and they can't get papers. So, cause they're kind of caught up in, I know it's a whole other story, but they live this kind of life where, you know, it's just, they're just, you know, can't get work, have no ID, you know, can't function in normal society. So up north, we work with the stateless tribes. So it's a real, it's my baby.
Yeah.
It's my baby.
Well, that is so incredible. Where can people find out information on that on Instagram or Facebook, or where are they at?
Well, we have a Animal People Alliance on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and then our website is animalpeoplealliance.net.
And so, where can people find out about you on the internets?
I do have a Facebook page that I can't access, that my manager does, because I quit Facebook a couple of years ago. But I'm on there, the official, but I'm active mostly on Instagram. Twitter, I'm active sometimes, but I think Instagram is the best place, and that would be Travels with Mrs. Mason.
Okay.
So, you know, but on my Facebook page, that's more professional stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm real active on Instagram because I love it, and it's like a photo album for me.
Yeah.
And I don't get all out and, you know, by the negativity. There's not a lot of negativity on there occasionally, but Twitter and the rest of them, I'm like,
it's a lot of shit.
Oh God. Yeah.
So much shit. Well, I hope that we get to see each other. I saw you at Christmas at, Cindy Lauper's thing, but I hope I get to see you after this whole mess is all over, but we'll see each other soon, I hope.
Absolutely. And next year when the Go-Go's have a few dates in LA, they moved it from this year to next year. So you definitely will be my guest.
I will love that. I can't wait to see you. Thank you.
Thank you so much,
Belinda. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's so nice to see you and talk to you.
So nice to see you. Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
And now we're going to talk to Belinda's son, James Duke Mason. He's an amazing guy. He's a political guy. He's a young politician. He's a young political maverick guy. Actually, maverick has sort of negative connotations, but I like it. I like it. I'm going to bring it back. I'm going to take it from Sarah Palin, and I'm going to give it to James Duke Bakeson. He's way better, more deserving. Hi, James.
Such an honor to be here. Seriously, I'm so thrilled.
I'm so glad you're here. This is great. We are at the end of our summer, which has not really been a normal summer. Are you sheltering in place in Los Angeles?
I am, actually. I'm sheltered in place in West Hollywood. And the only place I've been, other than LA, since March is I've gone to Palm Springs a couple times, but that's about it, you know?
Oh, okay. But yeah, it's been a strange summer. It hasn't really felt like summer very much.
It hasn't.
I know, it's weird. And it's weird that it's actually kind of over. Yeah. It's very strange for me because for me, summer is really, like, I usually spend most of my summer in Provincetown. So this is the first year I haven't been to Provincetown in many years. Do you usually spend your summer out of town or in LA?
Well, you know, this summer in particular was going to be very eventful because my mom, Belinda Carlisle from the Go-Go's, you know, the Go-Go's had shows on the East Coast in New York, and my mom actually had some shows in New York, both solo and with the band. So we had so many big plans for the summer. And then, of course, everything got completely, you know, ruined. So, you know, what can you do? But Provincetown, I was actually planning to go spend some time since I was going to be on the East Coast anyway, in both Fire Island and perhaps Provincetown as well. But of course, that got completely ruined as well. So,
oh no. Have you spent summers in Provincetown before? Have you been there in the summer?
I haven't. That's the thing. I'm a self-proclaimed West Coast gay. So I've been in Palm Springs, usually go to Palm Springs. I go to, Laguna Beach, San Francisco, and of course I've been to New York. I just haven't spent any time in the Pines or in Provincetown. So that was next on my to-do list.
Well, the Pines and Cherry Grove, it's interesting about how you're really defined on where you summer as your queerness is really defined by where you go.
That's true.
And it used to be, like the sort of trashy gays and the lesbians would go to Cherry Grove. And then the the big money gays and the daddies would go to the Pines. And then the drag queens and also the fans of drag queens would go, and the Bears would go to Provincetown. And now it's all kind of mixed, but everything's all sort of changed because now everybody hangs out together mostly.
Well, I know they have different weekends too, right? So like Provincetown, you'll have Bear Weekend, you'll have Carnival, I guess, which is like the sort of the big everyone in one place at one time.
That's where everybody does drugs.
Oh, I see.
So everybody goes to Carnival to do drugs. And then also, Bear Week is also fun because that's the best food. Mm. But also all the toilets get blocked. So you have to be careful. You have to really be careful during Bear Week.
It was everybody
because the plumbing is not. I know. The plumbing is not what it was.
They're not prepared for the amount of, you know.
It's a busy weekend, but the food is the best. You know, it's really delicious and it's really fun. I mean, but I love Provincetown. I mean, I think the whole summer is great and all of the shows. It's really quite amazing. It's similar to now. I think it would be similar to going to the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh if you like comedy, because it's quite amazing because in Provincetown now everybody has a show and everybody you've seen on Drag Race. All of the wonderful queens that have been on that show now have a show in Provincetown, or they did. And the best, too, even queens who don't have shows on or who haven't appeared on Drag Race, people like Dina Martina, who are amazing, or Jackie Beat, or, you know, people, Varla, people who are so, so amazing also are on every night. Mm-hmm. So it's a real treat.
Well, hopefully next summer things will be, you know, getting back to normal. I mean, we'll see. But at first it was like, okay, well, by the end of the year, you know, we'll be able to start doing things again. And now it looks like it could be next summer if we're lucky, you know, next spring or summer.
I know. It's almost like we don't even know. But it's kind of like what I think what's been great is that being like this has made me really appreciate all of the entertainment that we have been able to see,
yep.
You know, because it's so easy to take it for granted when it's out there all the time.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, absolutely. No question. I mean, the things that we all thought were sort of a given, that no matter how bad things got, we had, you know, we could see our friends, we could go to, you know, a bar and have drinks or whatever, you know,
right.
Those things that sort of used to give us comfort are the very things that we're not able to do. And those were the things that gave us, you know, sort of a respite from reality. But now, you know, we're all sort of stuck where we're at.
Yes. I mean, before I was able to go to bars, I used to really dream about the idyllic importance of gay bars and the idyllic importance of drag and how much I wanted to go and how much I couldn't wait to grow up to go. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as I started going, then I became annoyed with it. And then I took it for granted right away. And now I can't wait to go back.
Me neither. I mean, you know, where I live in West Hollywood, you know, we have a few places that have reopened. Like, for instance, the Abbey is back open. But unlike before, you know, it's mainly a restaurant. You can drink, but you have to order food. You have to stay at your table. You can only get up to go to the bathroom and you have to put your mask on. So, you know, at least there are a few places where, you know, there's some semblance of normalcy, but it's obviously still very different than the way things were.
And the Abbey is important, though. And also what's good about the Abbey is it's mostly outside. So there's something about that that's kind of like, okay, well, that actually there's a sense of like, okay, well, this has always been this way. So it seems like, and there's something, there's an established quality about the Abbey where if the Abbey's open, there's going to be a sense of like, okay, everything's going to start to feel like it's going to be okay.
Absolutely. No, totally.
You know,
I mean, it really is, aside from being a bar, it really is sort of a community center, you know, and, you know, it's a place where people go to feel like they're in the scene, in the community, you know, sort of the epicenter of the LA, you know, gay universe. So, you know, at least for me.
And politics, too.
Politics, for sure.
And politics is something that you've been involved with ever since I have been hearing about you. You know, ever since I've been knowing about you, even since you were a child, I've been involved and thinking about politics. You know, been a very politicized kid.
Absolutely.
And young man. What got you involved and interested in politics? What got you interested in the first place?
Well, it was a really weird journey for me because initially my first political sort of consciousness was when my dad, who worked in the Reagan administration, actually told me about, you know, his years working in the White House. So he worked at the State Department and he also worked as a special assistant to the president. This was the early 80s. So, you know, as a kid, he'd show me his, you know, White House memorabilia and stuff he had and photos. But then I also grew up sort of at the height of the, you know, the Bush-Iraq War sort of era where, you know, literally at 11 years old, my mom was taking me to see Fahrenheit 9/11. And so, you know, I had my mom's political point of view, you know, and so I was very rapidly sort of anti-war, anti-Bush. But my initial exposure was through my dad. So I had this interesting sort of mix. And then the fact that I came out at 14 years old, that sort of gave it an even more personal sort of, I felt like I had a personal stake in, you know, trying to make a difference and move things, you know, in a better direction. So that's sort of what motivated me to get involved. So, and then, you know, when I was a teenager, I worked on as a volunteer on Hillary's campaign in 2008. I was a page in Congress when I was 16. And then right before I turned 18, I started writing for Frontiers in LA, which is, you know, now defunct LGBTQ publication. But as soon as I turned 18, I was like ready to hit the ground running.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean, what a great thing. And then now, you know, it's so important because I think that young people are really going to make such a difference in what we're going to see in this coming election and how we're going to look towards, you know, this rebuild of what the, you know, where we're at now. I mean, we really do need a change and we do need the country to sort of come back from this terrible situation we're in.
Oh, yeah. No,
it's really awful.
I get so annoyed when I see people making, you know, nitpicky sort of comments about Biden on social media. He wasn't my first choice. He wasn't even my second or third choice. But, you know, this is no longer about, you know, what bill did Joe Biden vote on in 1986 that, you know, he voted yes on a corporate taxing decrease or whatever. You know, this is way beyond that. This is like existential, you know, level that we're on now. Like the minute that Joe Biden takes office, I say, have at it. You know, people can, you know, pressure, push, criticize, you know, try to push him in a more progressive direction. Like I'm all for that. But right now we don't have the luxury of it's either like someone who you disagree with on some issues or literally like pure evil, you know?
I know we cannot. I mean, we just cannot afford to nitpick and we cannot afford to divide any further. I mean, there's just no way. And I'm thrilled about Kamala Harris. Yeah. I think she is amazing. I would have picked her for president. Yeah. So this is she's actually my idea for president. Mm-hmm. She was my candidate anyway. So this is great. This is the next best thing. I'm perfectly happy with this ticket. Mm-hmm. I'm doing everything that I can to make sure that this this administration happens.
Yep.
Because Trump can still win. That's the problem. Yeah. People think, oh, you know, there's no way. Yes, there is a way because he'll cheat. He will dismantle the post office. He will do whatever he can to make sure that he stays in office. And it's really scary.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is like he's already thinking ahead to even if he does lose, you know, how he can just delegitimize the process, the result as much as possible. But that's even like getting ahead of ourselves. Like there is still, as you said, a very good chance that he may just win this election outright. And the mm-hmm. fact that, you know, I was in June, especially May, June, people were like, oh, you know, the polls show he's 10 points behind. I'm like, I guarantee you there's no way in hell it's going to be probably anywhere close to that margin. It's probably going to be, even if Biden wins, it's probably going to be pretty narrow. And sure enough, the polls are now showing that it has narrowed significantly and that in some of the big swing states, Trump is, you know, tied, if not ahead. So there's every chance he may win this outright. So people like, you know, unfortunately, I think we're, you would think after last time people would, you know, be over that way of thinking, but we still have a lot of people that have their head in the clouds, I think, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are people that are just, that are part in general, Democrats have often been, very, unrealistically idealistic. And also there's a lot of infighting within each other. There's a lot of imperfections within the Democratic Party that I know to be true, that there's a lot of idealism that's unrealistic, that there's a lot of infighting, that there's a lot of inability to, I think, accept reality. Mm-hmm. And also a lot of, I don't know, there's a lot of negligence, too. There's a lot of things like everybody else will take care of it, that I don't have to deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, totally. Totally. I mean, whether it was the 2000 election or 2016 or even this one, a lot of people saying, you know, oh, out of principle, you know, I'm not going to vote, you know, for whether it was Gore or Hillary or Biden. The thing is, like, we don't have that luxury right now. You know, it's like the Republicans will say, mm-hmm. we'll nominate a rapist or a, you know, child molester like Roy Moore. And that's okay as long as he votes our way on abortion and whatever else. But, oh, with Biden, he made one bad vote in 1986. That makes him unelectable or I can't vote for him, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's like these things that people are, they're like deal breakers. They're like, I'm not going to do that because of this. And it's just, it's really, Republicans are much more willing to consciously make these decisions in order, they're like, they'll go with the things that are sort of the lesser evils, you know, because they're more realistic about their goals.
Yep.
And it's very much like, I think that our party is really, we're really, we dismantle ourselves with our idealism. And it's really unfortunate because I know that we actually have a better society in mind. We have a higher mind and we have a higher purpose for ourselves. And we do have, I think, you know, I think we just are better people at at heart. But it's hard. It's hard.
Well, that's why, you know, like they pointed out, as was pointed out a couple of days ago, they don't even have a Republican platform for this election. They literally just said, oh, it's literally just we support Trump. You know, there's they've let go of any sort of pretenses that they even have a real agenda other than we support Trump. You know, and the thing about Biden, too, is the point I make to people who are not happy or skeptical. Yes, he made a few bad votes over the 40 years, but this guy passed the first climate change bill in the 80s, wrote the Violence Against Women Act, wrote, you know, the Brady Bill, or helped pass the gun control bill in the 90s, helped pass gay marriage, helped pass Dodd-Frank, helped pass Obamacare. So he's actually done a lot of really big progressive things. You know, and for me, like, I'd rather have somebody who's effective and who can actually get things done, who may have made a few mistakes over, you know, half a century, but who still has, you know, overall done a pretty good, effective job. So I'm actually, I'm as you said, I'm pretty happy with Biden-Harris as far as I'm concerned.
I am. I'm pretty happy. And I'm just happy with somebody who's actually had a political career and knows how to be a politician and knows how to tell the truth at least 99% of the time, as opposed to none of the time. I mean, it's like, I wish that somebody had been in office that could have prepared for this pandemic, who could have honestly took control of this situation in a way that a human being that was, you know, compassionate about people's health, you know, like, this is like, it's a crazy situation that we have. We could have taken care of this. We could have dealt with this properly.
Absolutely.
You know, that didn't have to turn into what it's turned into.
No, it didn't. It really didn't. And that's why it is absolutely true. And, like, literally, when we say it's a life and death election, it's all about ego. And, you know, it's, I mean, this convention has just been a total, like, parallel universe where, you know, and it's so sickening how they turn everything on its head where, you know, they say things like, you know, to save our democracy and to preserve the union, you know, we must vote for Trump. And it's like, but wait a second. These are the people who literally are dismantling our institutions and trying to gerrymander and suppress the vote. I mean, it's just so sickening how they totally perverse, or, you know, whatever the correct term is. They pervert everything to sort of suit their own interests. It's horrifying.
Yeah. It's horrifying, but it's also interesting that in every arena of corruption, there is something there. This administration have some hand in it, you know, whether it's, you know, sexual deviancy, whether it's Epstein, whether it's money laundering, whether it's cheating in elections, whether, you know, it's every arena of corruption. You will find some hand of this administration there. Yet, for some reason, there's no, you know, there's no retribution there. And I wonder why that continues to exist, even within the structure that we have, a kind of society now that we witness everything, we see everything, we have social media that exists where we see it all, yet nothing happens around it. So I wonder where the payback is, because either it's coming or it's not coming. I don't know what it means, you know?
Unfortunately, I have a feeling that it may never come, because, I mean, there are just so many things. Like, the fact, I remember the story from a few weeks ago about how Trump had the British ambassador, or the U.S. ambassador to Britain, you know, lobby to have the British Open at Trump's resort, or, you know, golf course in Turnberry. And it's like, I mean, that right there would be, under any other presidency, sort of like a defining scandal, you know, but because there's just every day, like 10 of those, you know, it's just impossible. So my guess is that if Biden's elected, you know, we're just going to be like as eager to move on as possible. And and so, unfortunately, my guess is that at least for most of it, there probably won't be any payback or accountability. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. I guess it's interesting, like, what is the lesson that we're here to learn? I always think that there's got to be, like, some lesson to be learned, or, and I always, like, wonder what is everything, like, to represent? Like, I always, like, wonder, like, what does this even mean? Like, the appearance of Kanye West and all of this, like, what is his appearance, like, in this have to do with anything? It's very strange. Like, it is very this strange. Is a very odd appearance of, like, mashup of the sort of, like, pop culture part of it that doesn't really make any sense, but it does completely, too, because this is also part of the reality television segment of it. I mean, is this all some sort of thing that will make sense? Is this all going to be a TV show that will appear later that we're all part of?
Well, as Elon Musk says, he's like, there's more than a 50% chance that we're all living in a simulation and that this is some kind of, like, you know, who knows? Maybe they're screwing, whoever they are, maybe they're screwing with us, you know, the aliens or right. whoever else, you know?
Like, I think we're all in some sort of giant in simulation. We're all in, like, some giant sort of reality show, like Love Island dream, like Big Brother house. This is like, this entire universe is like a Big Brother house that we're all going to get kicked out of or something.
One day we're going to wait. It's like the Matrix or something. We're going to wake up and be like, oh, it was all like a big reality show, like you said, you know.
I know. Well, I hope so. I mean, you know, what do you think it's like? I think the first thing that I will be excited about is that if he gets out of office, this is like, that would be the best. The other thing is getting out of quarantine. That'll be the next thing. What will you like to do when you get out of quarantine?
Well,
I think I would like to go to a gay bar.
Absolutely. That's definitely on the top of my list. I mean, you know, I actually, you know, I'm going through kind of a weird thing right now because, you know, my parents live in Thailand, in Bangkok, and we're trying to figure out if and when I can potentially go over there. But, you know, right now, there's a 2-week quarantine requirement. And even on top of that, you have to have, like, a medical visa and, you know, all sorts of, like, you know, it's a really difficult process to get over there. So I would say seeing my parents is definitely at the top of my priority
list.
Oh,
yes. Yeah. That's hard. Yeah. That's hard. I feel like I've just seen your mother because I've been watching the documentary, which is
right,
great.
Right. Yeah,
it's so great. And so I saw her at Christmas, but I just it's so funny because it's like, you know, she seems very nearby. She also seems very California, but of course she's very international.
Well, you know, she's definitely always been a California girl at heart. She always says you can take the girl out of California, but you can't take the California out of the girl. So, mm-hmm. you know, so, and you know, the thing is they always usually come back to visit. I mean, that was the plan. They were going to come here in May, I think. And then we were all going to go to the East Coast for the shows in June, July. And then of course normally I would see them at least every 3 or 4 months, but now who knows when the next time will be, you know? But
wow.
Thank God for FaceTime.
So they live in Bangkok? Oh, I know. Right.
They do. Yeah, they live in Bangkok. They moved there about 4 years ago, and they have a good friend who lives there. And they went to visit him about 5 or 6 years ago, and they fell in love with it. And you know, they were kind of looking for a new adventure, a new place to go, and they decided to literally just pick up and leave and move to Thailand.
That's incredible. I love Bangkok too. I mean, but you grew up in France, isn't that right?
I did. So I was a really weird kid because I was born here, but then when I was 2, we moved to France, and I lived in France for most of the 16 years. Spent 3 years of it in London, but by and large, until I was 18, I lived in Europe in France, and mm-hmm. so I was an American gay political dork. Yeah, teenager, yeah. Living in France. So I was a total, like, fish out of water, you know,
yes.
over there. But then I, as soon as I turned 18, I moved back. I moved back to L.A. and, you know, dove right into politics. And, you know, I was 22 when I first ran for West Hollywood City Council, worked on the Obama campaign in 2012, worked on Hillary's campaign in 2016, ran for city council again in WeHo last year, and... Though I didn't win, mm-hmm. I would like if I may say so myself, I think I did fairly respectably. And
yes.
You know, and now I'm writing political articles for a bunch of different websites. And, you know, I have my, as you know, you've been a guest. I have my weekly Dukes downloads that I do. So, you know, I'm, you know, I've sort of organically, you know, created this sort of, you know, little profile for myself that it has, you know, helped me or made me feel like I'm making a bit of a difference, you know, in some way.
Yes. That's wonderful. And what office do you have your eye on? What do you think that you would like to do politically? I mean, what sort of political career do you think would be good? I mean, are you thinking of like that sort of Newsom track or beyond?
I mean,
I think he's got a good political career, by the way.
Oh, yeah. No, I love Gavin Newsom. He's incredible.
He's quite good.
He's really good. And I mean, I think it's amazing, actually, how we have two of the like leading Democrats in America, both Newsom and Harris, who both happen to be from California. And,
yes.
And by the way, this came to my mind the other day that if Biden wins, we're going to have two women from California up on the dais, like standing with him during the State of the Union, both Pelosi and Harris.
That's great.
Which is pretty
That's
amazing.
Great.
But yeah, I doubt I'll run for WeHo City Council again. I'll probably wait a while and focus on my writing and on my, you know, sort of, you know, I'm working towards maybe doing some commentary type stuff on, you know, on TV. That's sort of what I have in mind at the moment. But down the line, I could definitely see myself running for maybe state assembly or, you know, even maybe one day for Congress. It depends on a lot of things. Who knows if we'll even have a democracy come, you know, a year or two from now, honestly. It's the first time in my life where I really can't see past the next, you know, 4 or 5 months, because a lot hinges on this election. If Trump wins again, who knows what the world's going to look like, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I'm just focused on the next 3 or 4 months and just trying to, hoping and praying that once Biden wins, we can all sort of get back to normal to some extent.
Right. We just have to think about, I mean, just definitely. Are you going to be working on different things for him? I'm going to be doing some things with Michelle Kwan for the Biden-Harris campaign, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
So definitely doing stuff for that.
It's so interesting with this quarantine thing, because obviously, like, you know, under normal circumstances, like in previous elections, I actually was an official surrogate for, like, Hillary's campaign, the Obama campaign. So they literally flew me to... You know, I went to Michigan, I went to Florida, I went to North Dakota, and I would speak at like gay pride events, you know, the parades and the marches, and actually, you know, speak on behalf of the campaign. But a lot of that kind of on the ground advocacy and surrogacy, you know, is not really happening, obviously, at the moment. So it's just the question is like, other than, you know, maybe co-hosting fundraisers or writing articles or posting on social media. It's like, what is there to do? You know, along with making calls, I guess, and phone banking and all that kind of stuff. But it's a lot harder to support these candidates than it would be under normal circumstances, you know?
Yes, but maybe with Zoom and things like that, you know, with Skype and Zoom and FaceTime and all of these things that we have, maybe the reach is even farther. We don't really even know, you know? So I think that the way that we can reach each other through this kind of stuff, you know, I think is interesting. So, you know, we don't have what we had 4 years ago in terms of the reach we have through the internet. So it's like pretty amazing what we can do now electronically that we didn't have in the last election.
That's very
so
true.
It's definitely improved. So maybe we'll even reach more people this way. So, you know, there's something to be optimistic about.
No, absolutely. And in fact, I find it really interesting that according to the Biden campaign, their fundraising has actually been, you know, even better, I think, than it was during, you know, before the pandemic, in terms of like the amount of money they were able to raise from virtual fundraisers. I mean, I couldn't believe when I saw the amount of money that they raised from, you know, doing virtual Zoom events, because, you know, normally you'd think, oh, people would, you know, would perhaps not be as likely to give if they can't actually see the candidate in person. But I guess, you know, I guess people are just really passionate and, you know, they're willing to give irregardless. So that's a really good sign that people are just so. And I think you're right that Zoom means that you hopefully can actually reach more people, because the people don't have to be in, you know, a certain city in order to attend a fundraiser.
Yes. Yeah. And we also have a kind of a desperation that we've never had. And it's really important, you know, it's really important that he win. And it's really important. I mean, we have to get Trump out of office. There's no other way that we're going to survive. I think we just have to. I think that this is just, it's just absolutely necessary. I don't think we can do this. We can't have him there anymore. We just can't.
We can't. We really can't. It's
it's not.
it's beyond at this point. But you know, my fear is, I you know, like I said earlier, even if Biden wins, I don't see how this ends well under any circumstance, in the sense that no matter what, Trump's definitely going to try to stay in office, and, or at least try to, you know, or at the best case scenario is he leaves, but he says the election was rigged, it was illegitimate, but I'm leaving because, you know, I don't know. That's the best case scenario, that he leaves. There's no proper transition. He basically just says, you know, go F yourself. And, you know, Biden comes in, but he's left with a big mess. And, you know, for sure, they're going to try to leave Biden with as big of a mess as possible, you know?
Yeah. So. Well, we'll see what happens, but we'll be there. We'll be there to help clean it up. Yep. And will you let us know, where can we find everything that you're about, what you're doing, where we can read your articles and your stuff on Insta? What can people find you online?
Thank you. Yeah, my website's jamesdukemason.com. And that includes all my social media links. I mean, I'm also on Instagram.com/jamesdukemason, Twitter.com/jamesdukemason, Facebook.com. So it's pretty straightforward. But yeah, people can go to my website and see my articles and my videos or interviews and all that kind of stuff. So
wonderful. Well, thank you so much. And I'm so glad that I got to talk to you today.
True honor, really. I'm so grateful and excited to be here. So thank you.
Thank you.
Never miss an episode of The Margaret Show. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Margaret Show is an Erios production with editing by Melissa Stetton and original score by Garrison Starr.
Taking over my dreams, waking me out of my sleep. I think I'm coming apart. Coming out of the dark, coming out of the dark, coming out of the dark. Yeah, I'm coming out of the dark.
An Erios original.
Powered by Acast.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.